When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name is George Cooper and welcome to the show. Fulham unable to put the bad run of results against Newcastle behind us as we succumbed to 1-0 home defeat. It was a smash and grab in every sense of the word. We were far the better team in the first half, but Bruno took his chance, put the ball in the back of the net, and yeah, as I said, smash and grab victory, really. It wasn't too much of a bad performance, but there were certainly areas that we could be improving on. We'll cover the whole game today in this podcast. Joining me today is one and only Farrell Monk. How are you?
I'm all right. George, how's everyone?
Yeah, good. Feeling a bit worse for wear. Good night last night. Were you drowning your sorrows after the defeat?
Maybe a little bit. I did my very best to forget about the result. Let's be honest.
Good stuff. Also, Vas Malik, how are you, mate?
Bonjour, George. How's it going? Sorry, I'm sorting out my French before my amazing cruise trip in a couple of weeks' time.
When is that booked in for?
You know, the same weekend that we're playing Man City. You know, last home game of the season. Very well organised by Fulham, you know.
So you won a cruise. So for listeners who aren't aware, Avas won a cruise during the... What game was it again?
Against the Spurs game.
Spurs game. He was tasked with kicking a ball into the centre circle and he won. And you got a riverboat cruise to Paris. And they've organised it for the day the reigning champions come to visit Craven Cottage.
Yeah, you know the day they might win the title? That day. But I'll miss. But if we have time later, I will tell you all about the farcical nature of this prize not really being a prize, more an expense that I wasn't planning on having.
All right, look forward to that. That could be a nice little Easter egg at the end of the podcast, so we can cheer ourselves up at your expense, admittedly, of us. Also, we've got Dan Cook with us. How you doing, mate?
Not too bad, actually. It felt like I was braced for impact as that second half wore on. So when inevitably we crashed, I was sort of prepared for the eventuality.
Yeah, it did. There was that feeling of impending fate. What is it with Newcastle, man? What is it? Have you got any three red reviews for us?
I do. I went to Twitter, had a little scroll through. There was some good bits on there. Jack and Loz, who, I mean, always their three word reviews are fantastic, and please go and read their post match blog because it was superb. I was trying to sum up yesterday, but they went with could have, should have, didn't, which I think is quite good. Richard Solbamba with tyne after tyne, referring to our constant woes against Newcastle.
That's very good.
And there was obviously, and we'll touch on this, I'm sure, but there was a load that referenced the triple substitution on the 60th minute. We had Davidoff with substitutions cost us, Joe Heatley with Silver's stupid subs, and Steve with Silver's substandard substitutions, which I liked. And finally, Fulham Fan News with on to next season.
Yeah, it did have the sort of feeling of on the beach. It's these last three games, really, Fulham, we've hit a bit of a spell of rough form. And hopefully we can sort of pluck ourselves out of this. Going into the game, Faz, it seemed like a very strong starting 11. Do you feel like the team that we went with is probably our best lineup that's available to us at this current moment in time?
Yeah, absolutely. I said to people after the game yesterday that probably that was our, if you took all of the players that we have at the peak of their abilities currently, that is probably our best starting 11 we could put out. And I think it shows what a good situation we have with the squad at the moment. We haven't really had any injury or suspension issues at all for the last few weeks. And it weirdly has coincided with probably our worst patch of form for the entire season, unfortunately. You know, when I did see that lineup, I thought, okay, and this is pretty good. And obviously it's well documented how many injuries Newcastle have at the moment as well. And this is a big opportunity. And it just unfortunately just didn't turn out that way.
I mean, the injury list for Newcastle is quite something. They had no Almiron, no Trippier, no Wilson, no Joe Linton. It really was a good time to play them, as it was when we visited their ground in Newcastle a few months ago. I mean, Dan, what is it about this Newcastle side? Why are they our bogey team?
I mean, Eddie Howe's vision and philosophy around football pongs slightly, and I think it's slightly kryptonite to a Marco Silva Fulham team as well. Often, and actually for quite a while, we've seen with Fulham, I think, a difficulty with playing against teams who have very little interest in actually contributing to a game of football. I think we've seen it time and time again that the more possession Fulham sort of rack up in a game, I think the more impotent we become. We thrive at, you know, moving the ball nice and fast. And in the first half, we saw it. We saw some lovely interplay, you know, movement where it's one, two touch passes in through that middle third, and suddenly you've got your wingers piling forward. But when you have 65, 70% possession, even more in that first half, I think it gets hard for Fulham to break teams down. And Eddie Howe's quite good at that. I'm not saying Eddie Howe's a bad manager, and there's absolutely many ways you can win a football game, and the way that he chooses to is very effective at times for Newcastle. But it does also, I mean, it causes them problems as well. I'm sure that there's a willingness from Newcastle fans to maybe be a little bit more positive at times. But I think that's where we struggle maybe a little bit against Newcastle, especially in recent memory. We just really do struggle. We struggled to break them down. We had so much beautiful play. I think Sammy said it on the quick take. We didn't actually create that many chances. Like we played some fantastic stuff, and I that first half honestly went by in like 5 minutes in my mind because I was enjoying it so much. I was having such a great time watching that game that it flew by. But I do think that we struggle against teams that really sit in against us and make it difficult to get through, and that's what Eddie Howe did, and we just never really managed to break through them.
Yeah, it was a very, very low block. Absolutely no intent to press or really take the game to Fulham at all. We were all over them that first half. I know, Dan, you said we didn't create that many chances. We did, however, have a few. There was that one that fell to Muniz after Andreas pounced on a bit of sloppy defending that he just lashed at a shot and fired it straight at Dubravka. And then there was another chance where Timmy Chestnut's brilliantly kept the ball in from a slightly heavier Iwobi pass and then managed to flick it back to Paulinho, and it just sort of glanced away from the face of goal. Were there any chances that I've asked that stuck out in the mind to you that you think really we should have been putting them away?
Well, the first one you mentioned, that Muniz chance, I thought from my vantage point, I thought it was a clear-cut chance. I thought he really should have done a lot better with that finish. But he did so brilliantly to create that space. And it's something that Dan's mentioned a lot in the quick takes, that he is showing us those striker instincts that he's now really confident to show. So when AP won that ball, he had a 1-2 with Muniz. But as Muniz gave the ball back to AP initially, he started backtracking a little bit to create that space for himself in order to get the shot off. It was just really unfortunate that when he then hit the shot, he was still going backwards at the time. So he couldn't put his full body weight through the shot, and it sort of petered towards the keeper. But that was, I thought, from my vantage point, a really big chance. And I thought if that would have gone in, that momentum shift would have just gone on and on and on. And we would have probably taken the second or third goal in that first half. It was all us for those first 20 minutes. And we were, you know, our passing was crisp, I should say. Our movement was brilliant. Our build-up, our interplay, we were pressing them high. We were all over them for those first 20 minutes. And it was that really nasty injury their keeper got in the 22nd minute that really changed the game and had a half-time a half time team talk, as it were, that even Marco called out as being tactical. That I think really changed the course of that game.
It was so blatant, and my dad was sort of losing his temper a little bit with the Newcastle shithousery. I mean, Farrell, do you feel like it was cynical? Because there was a real point, that was a point in the game where it was just all us, one-way traffic, and then it did just give them the chance to regroup. I mean, where do you sit on this kind of argument? Were you as frustrated as we were, or do you kind of think, well, you know, if that was Fulham doing it, I'd be all for it?
I think, you know, teams at all levels are trying to create a competitive advantage and exploit the rules as much as they can to their advantage. So, you know, I'm sure Fulham do it. And I just think it's just such a, it is a blatant and cynical use of the rules. Like every time Fulham were getting a bit of steam that you would see, whether Dubravka going down, a couple of other people going down to sort of stop the momentum of the Fulham machine. I did say on the quick take that I now know why they're called the Toon Army with their Mickey Mouse injuries all the time. And, you know, I saw it and I thought they're just exploiting the rules. There's nothing we can do about it. It's such a difficult thing for referees to clamp down on. You know, I think they obviously choose the keeper because they can't take the keeper off, you know, for that 30 seconds. Because there's that 30-second injury rule, isn't there? They have to come off and stay off for 30 seconds. And obviously they can't do that for the keeper. And look, it's clever. I don't know how we're going to be able to stop it. Yeah, nothing we can do, really.
I think what adds to the frustration with it is they did it to us when we were away at Newcastle as well. So it's not like it's a one-off tactic they use. When they're getting a bit overrun, they will use that tactic to regroup and readdress things a lot earlier than they ought to or have the right to. But it just takes the mick out of genuine injuries for me. Like, Lewis Hall got injured in the second half and everyone in the hammy end gave him pelters for faking another injury when he had done his hamstring or whatever it was he injured. And it just doesn't, it's a boy who cries wolf, and it just takes the piss out of people who get genuine injuries who need that time to be supported. And he's just sitting there having a chat with a physio, probably having some Lucozade, while the rest of the team regroups and fixes the mistakes that Hal started the game off with. I just think it's, that people call it dark arts. Like, I kind of call it cheating. But as Faz says, you know, it's bending the rules rather than breaking them. And it's just, you know, it's not how I'd like us to play. But having said that, if we were doing it, you'd think it's smart.
I do think it's funny. I really enjoyed the slight interview interplay between the two managers after the game, because Marco spoke first and voiced his displeasure and said that Eddie Howe and his coaching staff were actively shouting at Martin Dubravka to go down. And then they had their match little team meeting on the side of the pitch. And so Marco was saying that this was entirely scheduled. And then they asked Eddie Howe about it. And Eddie Howe said, no, we saw that Martin Dubravka was limping. And so we told him to go down because we wanted to send treatment on to look after him. And you're like, oh, good one, Eddie. That's a real, real good effort, that, mate.
It's basically exactly what Marco said happened.
But the keeper didn't, there wasn't like a reserve keeper, like getting his gloves on and putting his boots on.
No.
It was all a farce.
It's quite interesting because, you know, you think back to those little moments in the game and how it's going to affect. I certainly did see Newcastle adapt their game as they went on, something that Marco tends not to do with Fulham a lot. Newcastle tended to sort of, instead of trying to sit deep and absorb that pressure where Fulham were getting a lot of joy, winning the ball up high up the pitch and exploiting Newcastle in that way, they were defending a bit more on the front foot, and that might have been the trigger for them when they did that. They also changed shape slightly to sort of have a better outlet on the ball. Like, they sort of played like a 2-3-2-3 formation as opposed to when they were on the ball, they were just doing a sort of like normal 4-3-3. So I think that they adapted to actually go, okay, we need to get our team out up the pitch a bit more. Let's defend more on the front foot, create more triangles around the place that when we do win the ball, we can progress up the pitch better and there are more options. And I think Fulham actually struggled with that as the game wore on, really. But that must have come from that team meeting that they had.
Yeah, it was very, very, very frustrating. I mean, Dan, as you said, the more possession that we had, the harder we found it to create chances. Do you think that there was a slight tactical error of judgment perhaps from Silva, because it seemed like we were trying to rely heavily on working the flanks and putting sort of like crosses in, failing to kind of appreciate that the Newcastle back line consists of trees. I mean, the size of the Newcastle team in general across the board, they were
absolutely enormous. And I don't know, I felt quite frustrated that we seemed quite one-dimensional in our attack, especially.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a criticism and a fair one leveled at Marco at times, because we've seen it when we've had strikers playing up top, namely Carlos Vinicius, who aren't great in the air, and how long we persisted with putting balls into the box to someone who never won a header. But I thought we did get a lot of joy out wide, and especially in those first 25 minutes, there was like no support from Newcastle's wingers to their fullbacks. And so we had overloads time and time again down both flanks, because their wingers weren't tracking back. So our fullbacks had so much joy. I just think that partially with that low block, and also partially with, I think, the way we were set up, we just never seemed to have enough bodies in the box in comparison to Newcastle, because Newcastle was so deep, they had the extra men in the box. And ultimately, given the height or lack of in our team, your only hope is that Rodrigo gets on the end of it. But he's obviously being marked by Dan Burn and Fabian Scher, who are both very capable up top. You know, they can win a header, no problem. So I think that's where we struggled slightly. I guess the only time where it did really work, and it was sort of frustrating, is the chance, potentially even our best chance of the game, actually fell to Andreas Pereira, where, and I think it got overlooked slightly, but it's a cross that comes in from the left flank and Scher misses his header, and Andreas goes to head it, and I don't really know what he does, but he seems to sort of chest it towards the corner flag, and then shot doesn't quite come off. And I think if that falls to Muniz, I think we probably go 1-0 up. So I think we got a lot of joy down the wings. I think just actually that end product, and I mean, how often do we say it with Fulham, that last ball and that final ball? And I think that's tricky, where we say we didn't create many chances, but we had so many opportunities to create chances, and that was almost our problem. It was the fact that we didn't succeed at that final ball. And I think if we'd have done that more frequently, we'd have easily been 3-4 clear at halftime, I reckon.
Yeah, perhaps. What did you think of Andreas's performance, Farrell? I thought he, for large spells, was brilliant. He controlled the kind of our attacking momentum, a little bit wasteful in the shots, I feel. I think I've seen a few people comment on Twitter, we've had a few questions about his finishing and whether as a number 10 you kind of want more goals and assists from your number 10, but he does bring so much to our side in other areas. Overall, what did you think of his showing yesterday?
I mean, I've been quite critical of Pereira this season in particular, but strangely, he seems to be playing his best football at the moment when Fulham aren't playing so well. I've been so impressed with him the last couple of games, Andreas. I think he's just ironed out his decision making slightly. Like, he's not just desperate to overperform all the time. And, you know, he has the odd shot here and there, but, you know, I think he's taking shots from better positions rather than, you know, when we're like 4v1 and then he'll try and take a shot from a long distance. I feel like his productivity is just getting better and better. I think his decision making, I think his quality on the ball recently, the technique he's showing, it's really, really good. He's showing signs of being, you know, a top player. I think that Brazil call-up has really just made him shine, really. It's just a shame that it's just come when, you know, in a game where Fulham weren't totally at the races, weren't at Andreas's level.
I would like to see him, I think, and this is where partially I think maybe he's missing some goals that I think would seriously help. I think that ability to time your runs into the box, I think a valuable trait that some of the best number 10s in years gone by have had is that ability to arrive late, arrive at the right time. I know Bruno's not a 10, but that was a perfect example for Newcastle's winner, of a midfielder just sensing the moment that you need to arrive into the box. And I think that's maybe something that Pereira doesn't quite have, but I completely agree with Faz. I thought he was really good yesterday. And how often have we said it in recent times that as soon as he goes off, things do sort of seem to drift away from us a little bit. But I thought he linked up with Muniz really well. His set pieces are always fantastic. I think we didn't take a single good corner after he went off, and we had so many of them. I'm liking how he's playing at the moment, and that makes me happy, I think, because I like Faz. I've been critical of him, but I fundamentally just like him. He seems like a great guy, and you can never question his effort. It's just easy to get frustrated with his output. But I think you need, and I think Jack said it on the Thursday Club, you want your number 10 to be a little bit mercurial. You want him to be trying things and get frustrated that they don't always come off, because you'd ultimately we'd rather he was trying them than not, because he's then start to get predictable and things don't happen. So I think, you know, the random shots from 30 yards, whilst they can be frustrating, at the same time at the back of the Hammersmith end yesterday, the number of people I heard like, oh, why is no one taking a shot? And then as soon as Andreas Pereira takes one, everyone loses their mind. So I think you do need a little bit of that, yeah, enigmatic energy in that number 10 role, I think.
Stylistically as well, he's very different to what Fabio brought in the championship, where he was someone who'd come deeper just to bring the ball forward with himself, whereas AP loves to link play and do diagonal balls, or you know, play with Iwobi and Castagna to build upwards. So I think we're quite used to Fabio running with the ball, 1-2s and taking off a shot from like the edge of the D, whereas AP doesn't really play that way. He's more of a link-up player, more of a creative player. Well, he almost like assists the assists, if it were, which is like a nightmare for any FPL players. But he's, and like, I think as we were saying, when he came off, it did change a lot, because his pressing and his energy at the top of the pitch does a lot for this team, and it does create a lot of mistakes out of Newcastle, particularly in order for us to then create chances. And I think brings a lot that way that we didn't see when he came off, and that energy just dropped the moment that that triple substitution happened.
He reminds me kind of like prime Kearney championship kind of player in that regard, because he knows he's got the quality level to influence the play, not just up the business end of the pitch, but he's actually coming deeper a lot more now to influence play as well. And I think he's bringing a lot in both areas of the pitch, and I think that's really been helping Fulham recently. And you know, we're quite right, when he goes off, Fulham are a worse team, and I'm sure we can come onto the subs in a little bit as well. Like, regardless of how I've thought about Pereira in the past, I was very, very surprised Pereira came off yesterday.
Let's come on to the substitutions then. On the 62nd minute, there was a triple sub. Harry Wilson, Adama Traore and Sasha Lukic coming on for Kearney, Pereira and Willian. I mean, I don't think there's any two ways about it. It was a roll of the dice that perhaps didn't even hit the table. Dan.
I love that. That's fantastic, Coops.
It didn't come off, did it?
It didn't. And I've been annoyed about it ever since, I think, 10 minutes after it happened, when it was clear that it wasn't working. But maybe we sort of do have to just cede to Marco here, who has said explicitly that it was a fitness related decision as opposed to a tactical decision. He said that given the amount of football we've played in the past week, given the relative ages of a couple of the players that came off, it was a decision that had to be made. I think he said he wasn't trying to change the game. It was that we needed players who hadn't got as much football in their legs. That being said, and I completely get that, I just didn't think any three of them looked tired. And I think that's what frustrated me a little bit, because I think Tom Kearney has got like the worst poker face in football when it comes to when you know he's tired, because like it's just so obvious when TC's like blowing. And I thought 60 minutes in, he was still drifting across the park, running that game. I don't think Andres Pereira would ever actually want to come off. He strikes me as a guy who would want to play every second of the game, and his energy would never dip. And I thought Willian was great and really influential. And so if it just had to happen, I guess we have to hold our hands up and say, well, our hand was forced, but it just sort of felt like it wasn't. And then the players that came on, out of the three of them, I thought Traore had a good impact. By and large, and sometimes I guess he sort of flatters to deceive, because he does things that look so impressive and get you really excited, but how often does anything end up happening? But it's still fun to watch. I still like it, and I think it shits teams up, and that's a good thing. But I think Sasha Lukic, it's been spoken about, as a sub it's never seemed to work. I don't know what it is, but he just doesn't seem to adjust to the speed of a game when he comes off the bench. And oh god bless Harry Wilson, but he had an absolute stink when he came on. It just didn't come off for him, and so it's a real shame. But I mean, it's like everyone's seen it, everyone spotted it, the game died at that point. From our perspective, we never got a foothold back in it.
And like when you got to feel bad for, yeah, Marco in that circumstance. It's like, okay, yes, we've taken three really good players off who are playing quite well, but the three players you've got coming on, they're not bad players. We know what they're capable of. You just don't expect, you certainly don't expect Sasha Lukic to come on in the form that he has been in to not really have a great game when he came on. And we know how good Harry Wilson is. And obviously he had a stinker the other night, but when he came on, he really didn't affect the game as well. And going back to, we talk about Pereira's set pieces always being on the money. Some of Harry Wilson's yesterday were pretty poor, if I'm honest. The last thing about Saša Lukić, like, we've now seen his peak of his powers. I just hope it's not a flash in the pan. I've got this image of when Paitim Kasami suddenly became like a really, really good player for like three or four games. And then we just spent the rest of the year trying to chase that good player and it never came back ever again. I just worry that for Saša Lukić, really.
I might play a devil's advocate here for a moment and sort of say, I don't necessarily buy what Marco says about fitness, maybe with Willian. But as you say, TC was looking really comfortable. Pereira really very rarely like drops his energy too much that he needs to come off. And I wondered whether Marco was feeling a bit, getting a bit softer. And maybe he wanted to bring Lukic and Wilson on because of what happened against Forest and give him another opportunity to correct their errors or to make up for that game, or just to give him an opportunity to make them not feel so shit about how they came off after half an hour. Because Wilson came on the left wing, which is very rarely where he plays, and he was definitely ineffective as a result. And poor Lukic, as you guys have been saying, when he comes on as a sub, he looked so lost. And I made a point of watching his body language when he first came on because of how bad he is as a sub sometimes. Both Marco and Polina, with the first 2 or 3 minutes, were both shouting at him to correct his positioning because he was always playing like maybe 5 yards too high up the pitch. And you could see Polina gesticulating at him, like just to come back down, come back deeper. And he's looked completely lost. I also made a point looking at Iwobi as well, given that he came off as well. And he started off really well. I thought he was quite creative in that first half and he was quite energetic. But as the game sort of petered along, he sort of faded with it. But I don't know. I don't buy the fitness thing. I wonder if that's a bit of a protective thing. Because Marco really rarely does triple subs at 60 minutes. And I feel like there's more to it than that. Because like the decision to do that just opened us up so totally. And Lukic was so ineffective in the midfield. They ran through us. And we kind of changed our style of play because we suddenly started pinging the ball into the box like endlessly. And I was looking on Twitter and Kotic Taktiko had this really interesting stat that I sort of asked him a bit more about. Guess how many crosses we had in that game. What do you reckon?
30?
No, it's got to be.
Yeah, 37. And how many of those do you think were successful and got onto one of our players' heads?
One.
Six. So it's one in six, like a 16%. So you kind of think, like, after a fair bit of that, you'd think, although yes, crosses are a low percentage like tactic, you think you'd want to change up a little bit after a while. And although we brought on the two strikers, Raul and Broja, other than a Rabona in the 97th minute, they didn't really contribute too much either. And he just didn't think, like, we'd ran out of ideas. And I got more and more frustrated because I felt like we were watching Marco make a mistake in person or live as he was making those three substitutions. And it felt like we were the ones as fans that were punished for that mistake.
The thing is about the crosses is that it's not necessarily sometimes, and I know this is a definite tactic that people deploy, you know, you might not win that first header, but you need your midfield running onto it if they don't win it. And we just didn't see that ever, I don't think. And that's probably likely because the person that would be running onto it, people like Pereira, was not on the pitch. Paulinho did a couple of times, but nothing really came of it, really.
One of the things that I'd want to sort of touch on in the crosses, and I feel vaguely passionate about this, partially I think because I've got very defensive Anthony Robinson this season. I'm a big fan of his, and I think people look at cross percentages, and I think it's totally fair that 16% sounds low, but 16% is about par when it comes to cross completion rates as a league average in general. Cross completion rates across seasons tend to sit somewhere between 15 and 20% as an average, which, you know, you are looking at a numbers game of like 1 in 6, 1 in 5 are completed. It's not like a 10-yard pass that you should be completing 95% of the time. So I think it's unfair when people look at, and this isn't me shouting you down at all of us, but it's just like when people, I've seen it on Twitter in terms of like people looking at Anthony Robinson's performance yesterday and saying, oh, we've got our Jedi back. This is the real Anthony Robinson because he completed 12% of his crosses. Like, it's the numbers you expect. People don't really churn out higher percentages than that because you're putting a ball over across a larger distance at height into an area where you tend to be outnumbered. And these are all things that are like, going to go against you. So I get where people look at those numbers and it feels like we are just repeatedly doing the same thing and failing and failing. But if you play the way we play, those are the numbers of crosses you need to be putting in order to benefit from them. Now, there's a wider debate as to whether this is our best method of scoring goals. But I think based on the way we play, putting balls into the box is how we create chances. And you have to do it a lot in general. It's a numbers game. You have to put a lot in order to get enough on the end of enough to score goals.
I will concede that I don't know on average how many crosses we would do a game, but it does feel like 37 is quite a bit. And it did feel like towards the last part of that game that we were just pinging balls in at the hope that, as Faz said, that we'd get like a second ball or at least the first header on towards target. But I kind of just felt like, you know, doing it for 10 minutes or so and not succeeding really at all. I don't think we won one header that was significant. You think that we try to change things up. But I think that's why I brought up the stat, not necessarily because of the numbers. Well, mainly partly because of the numbers, but mainly because I felt so irritated by the number of times we're just hopefully just chucking a cross in. And the one time I thought we pinged a really good cross in was that free kick on the left in the second half that Wilson did, just for Bassi and Tosin to overrun it and then Pellini to underrun it. And it perfectly went through that corridor of uncertainty between them and missed every one of our players, which I thought was a relatively decent chance. If we'd got a touch onto, we could have done something with. I think I came out of that game rather frustrated because after 20 minutes, we should have been out of sight. And then to let them in with a relatively irritating, preventable goal, I was just looking for reason to be more annoyed. And those crosses numbers, they tickled me.
Yeah, I mean, whilst our triple substitution didn't really work, Newcastle made a few substitutions and they did have an impact on the game. I thought Harvey Barnes caused us a lot of issues when he came on. We want to come quickly onto the VAR disallowed goal. Should have acted as a bit of a warning sign for Fulham. I think we all agree it was the correct decision. Ultimately, it was a blatant foul. It was quite surprising it wasn't pinged up initially. But Dan, you said it was fairly preventable. Avaz said it was a fairly preventable goal. Is there much more that we can be doing? Do you think Leno could have got down a bit further? It wasn't that in the corner. I know Bruno hit it pretty hard, but I don't know. It felt like a very soft goal to me.
It was. I've seen some, again, I'm like Anthony Robinson's number one fan today. It seems like he's copped a little bit of heat for a poor clearance, and I kind of get it, but facing goal with a ball whipped across and you've got to clear it with your weaker foot, I thought he got a decent amount of contact on it. There's no way that, you know, when you decide to just put your foot through a ball like that, you don't expect that it's going to fall perfectly to who was their best player on the pitch that day. And obviously he can probably do better, but I think in general you make that clearance and everything's fine. It just was one of those moments where it wasn't. In terms of the VAR decision for the disallowed goal, I thought it was the right decision. Obviously he's absolutely clattered him. It really reminded me of, and we're going to get down a rabbit hole here, of away at Anfield in the league. For their, I think it was Endo's goal. No, it was Trent's goal. It was very similar. It was the winner. Bobby Decordova-Reed gets Polak's at the back stick identically, but it's at Anfield, so obviously you don't get that VAR check. And that's one of those classic cases of inconsistencies with VAR, but I don't think anyone can really complain about that. Dan Burn knows what he's doing. I think Calvin Bassey gets the flick on that header if he doesn't get clattered. I thought the referee in general had a good game yesterday, actually. I've seen Sam Allison's new into the Premier League, and great to see a black referee at the top flight. I think that's fantastic. It's great progress they're making with the diversity of referees at the moment. And I thought he was good to the point where I didn't really think about him all game. And I always think that's the best thing you could ever say about a referee, is that he didn't have an impact on the game, which is a good thing. And so full props to him, because other than that decision, which he missed but then was rectified, I thought he was really sound.
Yeah, no, I would have to agree. Very solid showing from the match officials. Faz, were there any standout Fulham performances for you? Any sort of silver linings, I guess? We've obviously mentioned Pereira and Robertson, who put in a good shift. Personally, I thought Tom Kenny was really good while he was on the pitch. But is there anyone else that you'd like to give an honourable mention to?
Just a bit of a side one, because I think it's worthy of a mention. I thought Tosin was better than he has been recently. There was definite, I was thinking that last few games the form has really dropped off. we expect better of him. We know how good he is. And I thought this was a bit of a turnaround performance. I thought his defending was really good. And one of his big key attributes to this, not just his defending, but for the whole team, is his distribution from deep is really good. I think it's top quality. The last few games has not been good enough. But yesterday, he was one of the reasons why we were able to progress the ball up the pitch quite so well. Like, is able to just break past a striker a little bit and then ping a ball through the passing lanes. I think that's a big asset to this team. And I think one of the reasons why Marco really likes Tosin Adarabioyo. And I thought it was a lot better than it has been yesterday to the expected level. So good. I'm glad because, you know, the defence is not really an area I really want to chop and change too much, really.
He also has extendable go-go gadget legs, which are so useful. Where, like, one of my images of Tosin when I think of him is the, like, a through ball that looks to set a striker behind, and somehow he just seems to, like, you're like a selfie stick when you just wheel it out and you just keep on getting extra length on it. He does that with his leg and just intercepts it and takes us up the field. I think it's a great asset. I love it.
Yeah. Where can you get those go-go gadget extendo legs? I need a pair of those.
You could do with them, yeah.
I would say the same thing, that there was times when he ran, like, halfway down the pitch, just angling along, and it looked like he was walking up, running at half pace, and everyone was running after him at full pace. He was brilliant with with those runs, and opened up the game so well. And I think that the extensions on his legs must have played a big role in that.
Also, I think I give a little shout out, maybe more on his first half performance than second half. But I thought Alex Iwobi, given how rough Tuesday will have been for him, that was a guy who came out yesterday and was like, it was bad Tuesday, but I'm going to show you guys what I'm about. And like within the first 10 minutes, he'd like spun Lewis Hall like three times. There was one moment where he did him so beautifully, where he's like faked to step over the ball and spun 180 and run down the wing. He left Hall in the dust. I thought he was really fizzing, and it looked amazingly, I think, like a guy who had confidence, even though he'd had such a rough week. And I think that's great. And I think probably something that Marco would deserve credit for, because he'd have given him that confidence to be like, I trust you, go out there again today and just show everyone what you're about. And I thought in the first half, he was quality.
It's a shame that he was moved into the 10, though, because I think it kind of like nullified his able to pick the ball up deeper and then run at the opposition team. It sort of nullified how effective Iwobi can be, perhaps highlighted by the fact that, you know, he probably should have just moved into the 8. Like, I don't think anyone would have been too disappointed. I mean, Kenny was having a good game, but, you know, I think the way that Alex Iwobi is playing right now, he's probably playing at a level above Tom Kenny. So move him into the 8. But, and like we talked about before, moving Pereira out of the team, you know, is a detriment to the entire team. So if you have Iwobi in the 8 and then a full Pereira ahead of him, it probably would have worked really well. But, you know, hindsight, blah, 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 blah.
It's amazing. I'm always marveling Iwobi's versatility, the fact that we can talk about him and saying he should have gone in all these different positions. I got a quick question. Who's more versatile, Bobby Deck or Dover Reed or Alex Iwobi?
Well, Bobby can play right back. So I think that wins him battle.
What was the song that someone did? And Bobby Deco Dover Reed drives the bus as well.
He drives the bus, he makes the tea, he referees. It was we all love Bobby Deco Dover Reed. Yeah, it was a classic. Avas, just quickly before we move on to part two. Okay, it's back-to-back defeats for Fulham now. And I think that yesterday, whilst it wasn't a particularly bad performance, I don't think it's too much cause for concern. It was just ultimately a bit of a smash and grab from Newcastle. But how do you think this Fulham side turn our fortunes around? If you're Marco Silva, what are you saying to the team as we prepare for West Ham on Saturday?
Well, it's coming off a rather bad week. 1 point off 3 games from a week that you'd think we'd get a fair few more points from is never ideal. But I think we've got a week now to regroup and address a West Ham team that's going to, I don't know if they're going away to Leverkusen, but they're certainly playing Leverkusen on Thursday, which is a big game for them. And they're going to prioritise a lot of their resources there. When we have a week to prepare for games, Marco's on it. Marco has tactics and the energy levels out of his players, the desire out of them to really go after teams. And I think Sunday's a great example of how I reckon we will be so much better than this last week has been. Although we've been a lot better this weekend, I think we're going to see a progression of that improvement on Sunday. And I think, well, you know, people talk about being on the beach and things. And I do agree to an extent, but I still think Marco's got that fire in him to not accept that from his team. We still got opportunities here to climb up that table. He wants to get at least top 10. And I think that that points tally from last season is still in the very, very distance, but it's still attainable. I think it's like 13 points we could get together. And I think he's going to give them the motivation to get these little wins here and there, because we've got big games coming up. We can really wreck people's seasons here. Liverpool at home, City at home, Brentford away, Luton away. We've got teams that are going for things that we can ruin their day. And I think that's good motivations, particularly Brentford away. If we can put them into real shit on that weekend, I think we've got plenty still to play for, as much as it's not for our own triumphs, as it were.
Who are we kidding ourselves? There is no way we're winning at West Ham. We just simply will not do it. It's like Newcastle. It just won't fucking happen.
One, we're away from home. And two, we were talking about how Fulham are very ineffective against teams who sit really, really deep. And
enter David Moyes.
Yeah. I just think we battered them 5-0, and I just feel like, yeah, why can't we do it again? I'm living in a hope of like, of not living in the misery of this last week. I'm trying to find some morsel of positivity.
Sammy asked me whether I wanted to go to West Ham on Saturday, and I was like, I will not be going to that game. Thank you very much.
What does Don Betts always say about West Ham away? It's like the second least interested he's in an away game other than Wolves away is West Ham away. And I'll go off whatever he says when it comes to those kind of trips.
His threshold for interest in away games, even though he goes to every single one of them, is like, actually like pretty high. Like it could be like Fulham in the FA Cup final, and he'd be like, oh yeah, I'm okay with going to this away game, basically.
Well, the way that he treated Forest away game was so funny.
Yeah, I'll give everyone a little tidbit into Dom Betts at Forest away. I was picking up a spare season ticket off him for yesterday's game. So I met him on the concourse at halftime, and I was like, oh, how you doing, Dom? He's like, yeah, here you go. See you, Dan. And he just turned and walked straight out of the ground into Nottingham Centre, got on the train and left after 45 minutes.
Oh, amazing. There's another away day that he hates Wickham Wanderers as well. I remember
Wickham is a bad away game, to be honest.
He's got this hatred for Wickham Wanderers that I don't fully understand why. He was at the Old Firm today, wasn't he?
I've enjoyed that.
Was he?
What? Yeah. What a character. Anyway, it's enough about Dom. that'll do for part one. Don't go anywhere, because we'll be back with some of your questions.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back to the Fulhamish Podcast. George here. I'm joined by Avas, Dan and Farrell. Thank you very much to everyone who got in touch. Oh, actually, before we start part two, little reminder that we are doing another live show at the Half Moon in Putney, the iconic Half Moon at Putney, who has staged gigs from bands such as the Rolling Stones, Kate Bush, Elvis Costello, and now you get this Motley Crue up there on that hallowed stage. But we will be joined by a real bona fide legend, at least in the football game, Paddy Barkley. World-renowned football journalist, a Fulham fan as well. He's been on Fulhamish a couple of times. He's a lovely, lovely man and a real character. So you don't want to miss this one. It will be one hell of a night. We'll be talking about the Crystal Palace game. It's on April the 27th, the Saturday. So do get your tickets. There's a link in the description to this podcast. They're going pretty fast, so I'd get them while you can. Don't hang around until the week before to see whether Fulham are on form or not. Just get them. It'd be great to see you. We'll obviously be sticking around afterwards for a beer. We just love doing the live shows. I think it's probably the favourite thing that we do with Fulhamish full stop. It's always good night, so do come along, especially if you've not been to one before. Right, let's get on to your questions. So we're going to start off with Lewis J. King, who asks, I'm going to throw this one to you, Dan. Why do you think we're so inconsistent and how do you think we change that? Yeah, we are, I'd say, the most inconsistent team in the league. You know, we can beat Spurs one day and then draw to Sheffield away, beat Brighton, lose to Nottingham Forest. It's a topsy-turvy world we live in. Yeah, how do we rectify it? And what is this inconsistency down to, in your opinion, Dan?
I think it's a fair question. I think an easy answer would maybe be that we're just like a couple of quality players short from pure consistency, which would be, you know, I mean, consistency from this Fulham team would see us finish in the European spots, right? And so I think any team that finishes in that mid-table, by definition, are inconsistent. You're looking at winning and losing and drawing a pretty much the same number of games across a season. It's the definition of inconsistency. And actually, if you look at that, at the table and the teams that are in that 7th to 13th where we are spot, they're all inconsistent. And no one's grabbed this European race by the balls and just gone, right, we're gonna win our remaining games. We're gonna turn over the teams we should be beating. We're gonna get some big results, and we're gonna get European football. No one's done it, and I think that that's just a symptom of the Premier League this season, and also a symptom of being a mid-table to upper mid-table club. It's gonna happen. It's obviously frustrating when you look at the table and you're like, well, it's the past three games we've played, we really should have won. You add 8 points to our league table standings, and actually we're flying. It is frustrating, but I think it's just a symptom of where we're at. And if we were to add this summer a couple of quality players with, you know, more end product, or a couple of more defensive minded players with fewer brain fade moments, then yeah, I think we'd see that consistency go up. But it is also just going to be a result of being a mid-table club. We're going to have these stupid little results. And also, we're Fulham. We love it. This is what we do. We're good at this sort of thing.
I mean, there's only one person who's going to be more frustrated at that, and that's Marco Silva. Like, he's seen this team and he's worked with this team that has taken 4 points off Arsenal, that has beaten Spurs quite resoundingly, beat Manchester United, although it was last minute, but we were definitely the better team that day, you know, and then mixing it in with some of the other results that we've had. I think that Marco must be sort of tearing his hair out at this inconsistency. But as Dan says, like, if it was predictable, we probably wouldn't be watching it with as much glee and hope as we do.
Yeah. Sometimes I look at this table and I just think, what the hell is going on?
It's nonsense.
It doesn't make any sense. How the hell are West Ham 7?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever just...
How are we, like, how are we 9 points from the team below us in the league?
Yeah.
I always think it's hilarious. Crazy. When you look at, like, when you actually dig into a Premier League table, because you get those sort of things where you look at, like, Luton, who going into this weekend had only won 5 games. They've now won 6. And if you'd have asked me to guess, I could have sworn that Luton had won 8 or 9 games this season. Because In my mind, they're turning teams over at Kenilworth Road every other week. Whereas, yeah, as you say, like, West Ham, in my mind, West Ham haven't won a game in 2024, yet they're 7th. Like, I don't know how this works, but you dig deep into it and you get very confused.
The other one that people in the wider Premier League tend to forget, like, don't highlight, but obviously we do, is, like, how awful Brentford's form is. Like, people always, like, people who don't look at it, go, well, Brentford are a good team. They're probably like mid-table. They actually look at them and like, oh my God, they're really close to relegation. But yeah, hopefully they get sucked in a bit further.
Avast, we got a question from RGWT, who asks, with Lukic playing more and Leno captain when no TC, are we hinting at Joao departure? I kind of thought it was quite an interesting question. I don't know whether, has Zhao ever been in the captaincy conversation? I hasn't really.
Well, I was going to ask you the same thing. I think you're looking into things a lot. I think you're looking into things a lot to consider that being the reason why he's leaving. I mean, he's still playing at a really good level. I think he still shows that passion. When Muniz scored that scissor kick, his first thing was he ran straight to the crowd rather than running to the centre circle. So I still think he has that passion for the team, passion for playing. And I think things like that are just going to drive you mad if you look for those kind of things. And I think just enjoy him whilst you have him. Let's not worry about what's happening until it happens. And we didn't think Pliny was leaving until, what, a week before the August window anyway. And even then it was like touch and go. But I also think that, you know, we're asking for a lot of money for him, and he's getting older, and the kind of teams that would need him or would want him are not prepared to pay with the kind of money that we're expecting of him or what we'd want for him. So it's going to be a really interesting summer for him, because if we do sell him, we need to sell him for a good value in order to really upgrade a couple of positions in our team, because he does a lot of work in that middle of the park. And I don't think the combo or one of Reed or Lukic really fits into that slot naturally the way that he does it. We might have to adapt our midfield if it were to be without Polina. But I don't know. I have a funny feeling that he might stay beyond this season. Again, I might be being blinded by positivity with that. But there's a part of me that thinks that because we want a decent figure for him, he's 29, turning 30. I don't think there are many teams that would be willing to pay what we want for him.
Well, he signed a new contract, didn't he? So I don't know how long for, but it must be a bumper deal. And I think Fulham would be asking for mega, mega buck. I would like to point out that, like, I'm not going to say it's a disaster, and I'm sure that they've got a plan for it already, or at least you hope you think so. Paulinho is so essential to this team that if we do lose him, it's not going to be a quick fix. They will have to adapt for it. I think that he allows the players around him to flourish, and there's so much trust that on Paulinho in that middle of the park that, you know, it just allows the rest of the team to sort of play with a freedom. I think it would be such a huge loss if, you know, and it will be, it'd be to the same extent as when we lost Moussa Dembele that time. You know, I think do not underestimate how much this team will be affected by someone like Paulinho leaving, because, you know, he is, as we know, way above our station, let's be honest. And the fact that we've been able to have him for 2 years at that level is such a privilege to watch. So yeah, as Avas saying, let's enjoy it while we have it, but, you know, it's not a case of, okay, let's get our £60 million and we'll be able to, you know, find a net benefit of it by getting two or three players to replace him straight away. It will be difficult for sure.
I do think the captaincy thing is interesting. I do think actually there's like a deeper thing to it in a sense. Marco, in his captaincy choices, doesn't seem to veer to the loudest or most passionate player. If you think of the players that captained Fulham this season, if we forget last season, because I'm pretty sure Mitrovic wore the armband a few times, but if you look at this season, the captains of you know, club captains of Kearney and Ream are composed heads who have authority, but are not the players charging around the pitch, screaming, flying into tackles. They're not the pure passion players. And then Leno and Harrison Reed, I think they're sort of, these are, I think, players who have a sort of a stance in the dressing room and like a calmness about them, which I think makes sense. It's sort of what you want in a captain. And I love Joao, but, you know, maybe your captain flying in two-footed into challenges every 3 minutes isn't exactly what you want. Sometimes you want a Tom Kearney who just walks into a situation, backs everyone else off and takes charge of it himself. And so I think there is like there does seem to be that level of thought from Marco that the captaincy isn't going to Andreas Pereira, who is senior enough in this squad to be a captain. It's not going to Joao Paulinho. It's going to players like Leno, Harrison Reed, who are a slightly different personality, I think.
Yeah, Tom Kearney's captain always does kind of, I mean, obviously he's a club legend. He's been here for so long. He is Mr. Fulham, but his attributes and his demeanour on the pitch aren't necessarily ones that you would associate with the kind of captain. You know, he is very understated. He doesn't necessarily like get stuck in the same way that Paulinho does. But yeah, it'll be an interesting one to see where our captain does go after Tom does eventually depart or retire or whatever it may be. But we'll see what happens, I guess.
But George, I'd also add to that. I think he's grown into the role, Tom, as captain. Because I remember when we played Huddersfield at home and AK-47 wanted to take that penalty off Mitro. And Tom didn't have enough authority within himself to really master that situation and ended up with AK missing that penalty. But I think if that situation happened now, I think he would approach in a very different way, but still be calm and get the way that he wanted as captain. So I think over the years he's matured, having got married, having had a couple of kids, that's really made him into a proper captain that we can all like get behind and trust in.
So you're only professional enough if you're married and have kids. I might as well quit my job then, shouldn't I?
But he's not the boy who was always worried about his hair now. Where before, when he get knocked over, he'd always check his quiff the first thing. He's not that kind of player anymore. He's getting stuck in a lot more. I think he's really grown into that number eight role.
Yeah. Let's be honest. I think he was probably given the captaincy to as a as a nice little sweetener when the contract negotiations were going on, whenever it was 9 years ago. Because we all know, like, you know, because Kevin McDonald was basically the de facto captain of the team when he was around. And then Tim Ream, it's like Kenny's like, you know, he's the one, okay, you can have that armband as well. But you don't know what these players are like behind the scenes. They're probably, you know, from Marco Silva's perspective, you don't just want one captain. You want 3, 4, 5, 6 captains all in the dressing room. It's just one that has the armband. In fact, actually, let's just do 11 armbands. Rodrigo Muniz, the captain. How about that?
maybe one day. We've got a question here from Ashley Mayhew. I'm going to chuck this one to you, Faz. Who's a realistic replacement for Tosin this summer if he leaves us? Mengi, maybe, from Luton. So Tender Mengi is the name suggested by Ashley. Have you got anyone in mind in particular? I'm going to open it up to the floor if anyone springs to mind. But assuming Tosin is going to leave this summer, which is looking increasingly more likely given the fact he's not signing a contract. What do you reckon?
The only one that really sticks out to me, I don't tend to go on the whole scouting mission about like, oh, I think we should really pick them up. But the one that's always stuck out to me, not just because of his age and his versatility, I think he's got the attributes of a top player. It just hasn't had a good run in a good team is Ben Godfrey from Everton.
I was really
impressed with him when he was coming up through Norwich, and then when Everton spent big on him, but they haven't really utilized him as effectively. And Everton are an absolute basket case of a club over the last few years anyway, so you know, I think he would do really well, especially since he's quite versatile as well. He can play pretty much across all the back line. You know, we've got attacking players who can be versatile in Bobby and Iwobi. We need probably a player that's like Ben Godfrey in the squad. But I also think that we've probably got a ready-made replacement in Diop, really. I quite like Issa Diop. I think maybe his peak isn't as high as Tosin, but I think he's a pretty good player, if I'm honest. And it's just the fact that, you know, Tosin's playing really well has kept him out of the team, really. But I think that Diop's pretty good enough for this team anyway.
Yeah, anyone want to add anything? Any names?
I think Faz is right in the sense that you've got Diop there and he does slot into that role and there is a like for likeness there. I would also be really disappointed if that happened, because I think that's a lack of progression from Fulham Football Club, and that's what we saw this summer. And you know, ultimately we've yo-yoed through this season so much that we weren't sure whether we had progressed or we hadn't, and now I'm pretty sure we've sort of remained fairly stagnant. And if we do that for another season, it will be frustrating, and two, it could start to become detrimental. You look at the teams that might come up out of the Championship this season, they're far better than the teams that came up last season. So you've already got trouble there. So I would, as much as I think Issa Diop has been good for Fulham, and I've said it before, I think 99% of minutes in games, Issa Diop plays really well. I think the 1% where it goes wrong can sometimes be a real pain in the arse and cause us a lot of issues. And I would just like to see progression there. It would be a real shame if the reaction to Tosin leaving was, oh, it's fine, we'll bring Issa Diop in, we'll sign a centre back on loan who'll cover if someone's injured. Like, it would be nice if we actually went and said, you know, if you look at one I'm looking at, if Southampton don't go up, for example, with someone like Taylor Harwood-Bellis, who I think is superb, and you actually go out and you splash money on a 22-year-old centre back with pedigree, who's learning his trade, who is homegrown, and you commit to progressing as a football club. And so that's the sort of thing I would like to see.
But that would happen if we had a forward-thinking board who pre-planned what they wanted with Marco and bought players timely so that they could integrate with the squad before even pre-season started. And we all know this song and dance. We talk about it before every window in the hope that this one might be the one that changes. And I think like Taylor Harwood-Bellis is such a good idea, a young centre-back who's got the future ahead of him. But like we all know how this is always going to end, as like we're hoping and wouldn't, which is we'll take our time, be rumoured with 1,000 different centre-backs, all brilliant, all young, all old, whatever they may be, and then end up like loaning someone from, I don't know, Bournemouth or something on the last day of the window. I was actually just Googling to see what our rumours were for centre-backs over the last window, and there's like a plethora of them. I just don't think that like there's ever been any concrete plans that we are ever privy to. So we don't really know what the rumblings along the back. And you like to think that with us getting past this PSR from this January, that this might be a big window. It's something that we've said for the last couple of windows. But we're in the hope that because we, and so many clubs, didn't do anything in January, that it's going to lead to a really big summer. And we do have a fair few places that we need to upgrade, centre-back, of course, being one of the major ones. So you like to think that this summer is going to be big. And hopefully Marco can redrum that into the board. But, you know, I won't hold my breath for it.
Last one thing I'd like to say about Tosin as well, Coops, is that I know he's had some uninspiring performances, and he's not been great recently. I've so passionately stuck behind Tosin since he joined the club, because I've been firmly of the opinion that in terms of financial asset, he's one of the biggest we have, and I hope this doesn't happen. I think it's possible. I also hope for him, maybe it does happen. If he leaves this summer, I really think if he gets the right move, if he makes the right decision, he will be in the England team within the next 18 months. I think he will be in an England squad. And I was saying to my mate, who's a Newcastle fan, I think as a sensible signing goes, if Newcastle were to pick Tosin up on a free, I think within the next 18 months, Tosin gets into the England squad. I think we've got a seriously good centre-back, and it's a real balls up. And for a player that we bought for £1.5 million, we're going to somehow make zero money off it, because he's £30 to £40 million player. And yeah, that's gutting.
It is. I think if you look at it that way, in those real money terms, it is a bit of a gut punch. However, we picked him up for £1.5 million, we've got more than his money's worth, let's be honest. Like, you know, he's been a very good servant for us. He obviously thinks that, you know, the contract that he, you know, deserves is better, but you never know. Well, no one might come in for any offers for him, and we end up picking him up. Just one last suggestion I'd like to make is Jordan Breyer from Burnley, a really good ball playing centre back. You know, that Burnley team, they're actually a pretty good team on the ball, and you can see the way that Vincent Kompany likes to play football, and it's quite similar to how Fulham play. So I think that picking him up, I think he's only like 21, 22, 23. There's a lot of potential there as well that I've seen, and I think he would slot nicely into Fulham.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad shout at all. Hopefully Tosin stays and we don't really need to entertain this, but it's always hope for the best, prepare for the worst, as they say. I think that will do for today's podcast. But before we end, Avas, I just want to touch upon your riverboat cruise of Paris and the ins and outs, what the itinerary is saying. Most of us can only dream of picking up a prize in a halftime show at Fulham FC, and this man's actually lived experience, and has it lived up to expectations? What's going on?
Well, a resounding no is the answer to that so far. time will tell whether it is, but so essentially it was quite cool to start with. So I was sort of in the corner between the Riverside and Hammersmith before the half ended. So I saw Muniz's goal from that vantage point right next to the corner flag. So I was shouting abuse at Madison, who was taking corners, and no one was joining in with me, and I stood out like a sore thumb, but it was great. So I walked onto the pitch. It was really cool. You know, got a lot of boos from the Hammersmith end, some cheers from the Riverside, who were more eating prawn sandwiches. But once I got the prize, I got this massive check, and they didn't know what to do with it. I was like, can I keep this check? And they're like, no, you got to give it back. And they gave me this bag full of goodies. They were all like pens and like paperweights and not much used to it, but this like massive bottle of champagne. And I was like, I don't drink. Like, can I have something else? And I'm like, no, that'll do. You take it away with you. So I gave it to like the person sitting next to me in the Riverside, and they were very grateful for it. And then I didn't hear from them for like a week. And like, I was like, I didn't have anyone to contact. I was like, this is a scam. And they finally emailed me, and they were like, here, give us your details. I gave them my details. And then it came through what the prize was. So I'm going to go to Southampton on the Friday before the City game, get there for 5:30 plus one, of course.
So then I said to them, like, okay, so if I were to drive, where would I park? Oh, parking is £75. I was like, okay, great. That's useful. So the boat itself, the
ferry, and that's not covered.
No, of course it's not covered. This is the prize is the boat, Coops. And so the ferry itself is very nice. The cruise is very nice. They've given us a relatively nice room. Wi-Fi is £25 per day. If you want to go to any of the restaurants, some of the basic buffet type restaurants are fine. But if you want to go to any other ones, you've got to reserve and pay separately for those, which is, like, I suppose, understandable but still annoying. There's Dodgems on this cruise, which means I might not even go to France. I might stay on the cruise. But then, right, so they take you to Le Havre rather than Paris, which obviously makes some sense. But in order for us to get to Paris, you've got two options. Either you make your own way there and come back within time. So you get off at like 7 a.m. You've got to get back by 9 p.m. for a 10 p.m. departure. So either make your own way there and back, or you can pay €200 each for them to take you there and back. And with that, the greatest selling point of that is that you'll get 4 hours in Paris. So I was like,
£200 each.
Yeah.
A cool 400 between the two. That's £100 an hour.
Paris, €400. So I was like, I could have taken the Eurostar and I would have had a lot more time and more money in my pocket. And so we're trying to work out how to maximize our time. And it's just essentially what it's going to be is we're going to go get some croissants. We're going to line up in the Arc de Triomphe and maybe go to Louvre and then have to run back, like Home Alone style, back to to Le Havre again, just to get back to Southampton at 5:30 on the Sunday, pay the £75 for the parking at 6 a.m. and then try to potentially, hopefully, if the game gets moved to the Sunday, go to the City game on the Sunday. But yeah, it's a great prize so far. It's just going to cost me a fair few hundred euros just to do it.
Do you think you'd be able to convince, maybe take that €200 that you would have paid to go to Paris, just give it to the captain, and sailing back, just go via the River Thames to Putney Pier instead?
Oh, we know, that'd be a great advert for the Putney Pier. Just drop me off there.
Yeah.
Right. That's enough for today, I think. Have you got a favourite three-word review, Dan, that you'd like to use?
I do. Yeah. I think I'm getting wary of this. I think Sol Bamba's really got a favourite here. I constantly pick out his three-word reviews, but he is brilliant at them. So I'm going to go with Sol's Tyne after Tyne.
Nice one. Very clever. Good stuff. It was cathartic, gents. I feel a whole lot better having talked it through. Sammy will be back on Thursday, looking ahead to our trip to, I was going to say Upton Park there, but the London Stadium. So everyone who's going, I hope you make the most of it, shall we say. Until then, Farrell, it's been a pleasure, mate.
Thanks very much, George. Thanks, everyone. Oh, one last thing. I'd like to wish Stuart Boyne a very happy birthday. That's all I've got to say.
Happy birthday, Stewie. Avast, pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me. Au revoir.
Au revoir. Yeah, I look forward to hearing the update after you've had your little tour around Paris. I'm just imagining you with a little beret.
Oh, I'll take that picture. I like hats. It's give me a good idea. I will buy one.
Yeah, please do. And Dan, I'll see you very soon, mate. Cool. Take care. Have a good week. And yeah, come on, you whites.